This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Tired of not getting a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Stamps.com. When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hey, hey, I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show where I look at what's happening in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. So a few weeks back, I made an offhand comment about how he who should not be named, a.k.a. Drake, had devolved into this depressed, mopey, vindictive rap state, and how I was officially done. A lot of you reached out saying you were done too. Boy, bye. And Drake isn't alone. We're going to get into this more in a minute, but gosh, the boys in rap are sounding sad. Meanwhile, the girls in rap are killing it. They're killing it so hard that finally, the women are crashing the usually male-dominated rap nominations for the Grammys. They have the beats, they have the hits, and they have something to say.
I would like to address a certain incident that I'm sure is on everybody's mind. No, I don't know why Popeyes took the hottie sauce off the menu. And Hines, if you want the sauce back, you need to take that up with the Popeyes lady, not me, okay?
And my next guest, Sarita Singleton, and her collaborator Issa Rae have been watching. And they worked together to make the Max series, which we'll call Rap-ish. The real name of this show has a word in it that I'll get fined for saying on the radio. Rap-ish is all about these two Miami girls, Shauna and Mia, who end up forming a rap duo.
Okay. Justin, Franklin, Produce, Esky.
It's loosely based on the success of the rap duo City Girls, two of my favorite rap girlies who are killing it right now. Which, excuse me, where is their Grammy? Anyway, the show gets deep into how Black women are treated in the music industry.
We should start a rap group.
Mia, come on.
Man, y'all, we finna start a rap group. And of course, I'm finna be the pretty hype bitch.
It's fun, it's funny, it's very real. And I have been loving the show's careful observations and big critiques. Today, I'm getting into all of that and more with the showrunner of the series, Sarita Singleton. Sarita, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Thank you. Thank you for welcoming me. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, I'm glad. We're excited for it too. I enjoyed the first season of what we'll call Rap-ish. I have gotten to see some of the second season. I've been loving it. I think that one of the things that is the most interesting to me about the show is that it's like capturing the moment that hip hop is in right now. In my personal opinion, and I think this is something that other people have noticed as well, it seems kind of like a lot of male rappers are in this like depressed, paranoid kind of state. This is not the party good time music.
What happened? We need T-Pain back.
Exactly. Please bring T-Pain back. But I feel like there's a little opportunity there though, and that it kind of leaves a lot of the women to have all the fun. And I love that the show really is capturing this moment as well. What is compelling about this moment to you as a writer? And how do you hope to bring that to life on the show?
Oh, I mean, well, first of all, I'm just, as a woman, as a Black woman, and as a fan of hip hop, like I was just excited and watching along with everyone else as Cardi made her debut.
Yes.
And then it's like, oh my God, now we have two? Like, exactly. Nicki and Cardi?
Yeah.
And then the City Girls and all these like kind of really organic moments were happening online where you're discovering all of this new music. Mm-hmm. We're seeing art be discovered on social media. We're seeing people be defined by numbers right now in a way that is like you know, what works, what goes viral. Like,
right.
Imagine figuring out who you are, building a brand, building a career based off of, like, how many people join your live.
Right.
Based off of what you say and what you share and how unhinged you are. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. We all kind of interact with it to a certain degree, but it does take on a very specific place on the show. The show often uses like phone screens and social media. You know, characters look at social media or watch or film something, or the frame will actually have us feel like we're looking at a live stream actually unfolding right then. And I like that as a device because it kind of shows the fault line between the hustle and success. Like the characters sometimes show one side of things for social media, like, oh, look at our tour bus, for instance, with this season. The girls are on tour. Look at our tour bus. This is so nice. But then when they're staying in the raggedy hotel room that might have roaches and bed bugs, they're not going to post that to social. I wonder, is there like a commentary in there about the way that the music industry works?
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. There's a photo or like a meme that I've seen online sometimes where it's like you see the person holding the camera in their backdrop,
mm-hmm.
but on the floor there's like chips and like, you know, my clothes
phone
from
cords
yesterday, and phone cords, all of that stuff. And it's just what you want people to see versus like the reality of a situation. And that's something that we really wanted to show because we want to show like how gritty it is, like how rough it is, and like those kind of sacrifices that you have to make. And so you'll see that there are less moments of them pulling out the phone because it's just like they are very protective of like what the fans think, that people think they've made it.
Right.
I'm on tour. Like, you know what I mean? And then just the idea of what tour is like,
right. It's glamorous.
It sounds very glamorous, but it's like you're the opener to the opener. And like, right. You're not being paid anything. And you are sleeping in a tiny bunk with like no food. So, you know what I mean? Like, people don't know that, like that hustle.
Y'all really get into the dirty underbelly of the music industry as they're breaking into it. As you said, it's not glamorous at all. Issa Rae, who created this show, she's made comments to the tune of, you know, the music industry is the worst business she's ever come across, even more so than Hollywood. In thinking about the tour specifically, underhanded dealings, shady dealings in the music industry is nothing new. But the way that you all show it this season through the tour specifically, it really exposes a lot of the racism, colorism, misogyny, and sexism that real life artists and Black women in the music industry have to deal with. And I appreciate that because you all do a great job of showing and not just telling me as the viewer about those aspects of the business. What was your team's approach to depicting that and the effect that it can have on Black women in music?
You spoke earlier to like how depressed so many of the like male rappers seem. It's so drug fueled. And it's like, hey, let's just throw them into this world. So we hit those themes really hard in those first, you know, tour episode, even for some of the most notable artists. Like I think about Latto and the story that she was sharing, and she never named the rapper who refused to clear their verse for her album because she wouldn't sleep with them.
Right, right.
The audacity. Like, you know what I mean? The gall.
Yeah, the audacity.
It's like things like that are still happening, and they have been happening for, you know, decades. We're in 50 years of hip hop. And I think some of the men are, they still want to maintain their like grip and their control. And it's like, and how do they do that? By like policing, undermining, exploiting.
One of the things that really got to me when I watched the first season of Rap-ish and again with the second season is how rare it is to see a story about women centering on their drive to realize their goals as opposed to like find a partner. Mia and Shauna, romance is a part of their lives, but the show was really about them finding their voices as artists and figuring out how they want to work together and what they want to say with their work. And that feels really refreshing. Why was it so important to focus on that with this show? And I wonder how you relate to that as a creative yourself.
You know, friendship between women has been like my favorite thing to write about since I discovered that I wanted to write, you know, that friendship or that connection that you have with your bestie, like that's where you share your dreams, your goals, your mm-hmm. fears. You know, that's where you're most vulnerable sometimes. I just recently came across a photo that, like, my best friend, Morgan, wrote on my whiteboard when I was maybe like 19 or 20 in college. And she mm-hmm. wrote, like, keep following your dreams. They're amazing. And, like, I love you so much, and put like a little heart on it. And I like took a photo of it. Sometimes your girlfriends are your biggest supporters. And then also like the landscape of hip hop and like supporting each other and deciding that mm-hmm. we're no longer going to beef with each other unnecessarily. We're not going to let men pit us against each other. Sure, you have your drama, you have your beef, and you have your fights here and there. But for the most part, I think the women have really, how can we coexist with one another? And I think that's why we see so many, like an abundance of women rappers who are all winning at the same time. It's because they've refused to play into that.
Another aspect that felt very authentic, but also just had me howling, was when Shauna gets her period on the tour bus in the middle of the night. She has just looked at her phone and seen that she has less than $25 in her account. And then she's like, oh my God, and my period just started. You know, we see her trying to find a tampon and having to press on, just continue to move forward with her cramps and all. I knew cognitively that this is a reality for many touring women rappers. In the back of my mind, I understood that. But seeing it depicted as the day ruiner that it sometimes can be, even for the character on this show, it hit me in a totally different way.
Reality doesn't stop. Like, just because you're on a tour bus. And also, I think, like, just even as women, there are a lot of women in our writer's room. We were just like, how often do you see a woman get her period on TV and have cramps?
And it happens all the time. It happens all the time.
It happens to us all the time, but it's not something that, like, I don't know. Sometimes things are a little more like depicted in a more sexy way. Like, these women get periods, but don't think about it. You know what I mean? But now it's just like, oh, we want you to think about it. Like, think about everything she's dealing with right now.
Another way that I think that the show mirrors what's happening in rap is that Mia and Shauna are very empowered sexually. Women in rap these days are having quite a moment with sexual empowerment. I'm thinking of Cardi B and Meg as like the queens of this. They got back-to-back hits with WAP and Bongos. But of course, we also see it with Latto. We see it with Sexy Red, all the other girls. And this is reflected in Shauna and Mia's music as well, but also in their life. Like, the sex on the show is so well done. The thing that I really like about it the most is that when I'm watching the scenes, I can see that it's not just about Mia or Shauna feeling desired. Also, you can see them experiencing desire. You can see them excited about what's going to happen. You can see them wanting their partner. And when you kind of compare that to some of the discourse that's happening in Hollywood around sex scenes, you know, I feel like in some ways, there's less sex on screen than I even remember when I was growing up in the 90s or 2000s. And there are people who are against it and think that it's unethical or it's too gratuitous. I wonder how you all on your team have talked about approaching the sex scenes in the writer's room and what your philosophy behind it all has been.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. And it's funny that you're saying this because I was talking to my mom last night and my mom was literally saying, like, you know, I think for sex scenes, you just gotta like show the beginning of it and just get out. Just show the kissing and then shoulder slip and then just get out.
You know, I was like, that's enough.
I know that those opinions exist and I hear them from my mom all the time. A lot of our writers room, a lot of our team, like across production, are women. And so when we're talking about sex and desire and how we have sex and when we have sex, like, we are not at all thinking about a critique, a judgment. We're not policing ourselves. We're not pulling ourselves back. We are speaking about it as we experience it. It's not anything that I wouldn't do in my own personal life. You know what I mean? So I'm like,
good for you.
That's
good
what we for you. Yeah. Does this align with my values? And it's like, yeah, it does. So here we go, you know?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I also have really appreciated the show's approach to sexuality because one of the main characters, Mia, is a mom. I find it exciting how the show continues to show Mia as a sexual being and having roles and desires outside of being a mother, which she enjoys. That brings me to another aspect of the show, which is the way that it depicts Mia's journey as a mother and an artist. It also reflects a very real aspect of the music industry that isn't talked about as much, despite the fact that so many of the most popular women in rap right now are moms.
Yeah.
From Nicki to Cardi to Sexy Red, currently on tour right now, pregnant, doing the splits, hitting the splits. I saw her. I was like, wow.
I didn't see the splits, but yeah. But
I saw the splits. I said, go ahead, girl. I'm like, if you can do that now, delivery is going to be a breeze. But work-life balance for any mom is always going to be a thing. But in their specific situation, in Mia's specific situation, trying to balance the work, the artistry, the motherhood all at the same time, even though there's many other women in the music industry for whom that's a reality, it still isn't talked about as much as I think that it could and should be. Why was it important to foreground that in the show?
I think for all the reasons that you just mentioned, but also it's my story. You know, I'm a mom. I'm a mom of two boys, and I entered this industry around the same time as Mia. You know, Mia, our characters, we don't really talk about their ages often, but they're about 24, 25 years old. I came into this industry as a young mom, you know, trying to figure out that balance and like sacrificing and hoping for like a better future. And and even when we talk about the story of Mia and her arc and her experience as a mom who's just trying to like be better than her mother and also feed her daughter, a lot of times it feels like you've hit your expiration on your ability to dream. That was something that we talked about a lot with season one. It's like, that's what Shauna gives her, is like this permission to want more for herself. So writing her story is one that is just deeply personal for myself and for some of the other moms in the room.
Well, Sarita, thank you so, so much. It has been just a joy to talk to you about this show, and I'm excited for people to see the rest of the second season.
Thank you, Brittany. Thank you so much.
That was Sarita Singleton. She's the showrunner for Max's Rap-ish. The second season is streaming right now. Coming up, we're staying on theme and tuning into a conversation with one of the most delightfully weird and renowned rappers of all time, Andre 3000. Stick around.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu. This message comes from NPR sponsor Discover. Here's a familiar situation. You have a question about your credit card. You call the number for help and can't get a hold of anyone. If only you had a Discover card. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. A real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Vuori. Jump into a new perspective on performance apparel. Vuori makes products that stand the test of time and hope to inspire others to live vibrant, healthy lives, empowering your best life in clothing that can be worn for just about any activity, from running to yoga. Visit Vuori.com/NPR to receive 20% off your first purchase and enjoy free shipping on any U.S. orders over $75. Discover the versatility of Vuori clothing.
Next, one of the most imaginative, genre-breaking, and influential rappers of our time. The man who's in everyone's top five, Andre 3000. Like so many of us, I grew up on Andre 3000, both his solo work and his work with Outkast. Whether we're talking Equimini, The Love Below, or even the smattering of features he's thrown at us over the past couple decades, 3000 is one of the few people I'd actually say has a perfect discography. And for the first time in 17 years, he's released new music with an album titled New Blue Sun. But longtime Andre 3000 fans may be surprised because this album has no rapping. In fact, it's mostly improvisational woodwinds. And while some might be disappointed, it's one of the freest expressions of style I've ever seen from an artist. My colleague at NPR Music, Rodney Carmichael, was lucky enough to sit down with the Andre 3000 to get the whole backstory. I'm going to hand it over to Rodney. Enjoy.
Andre talked to me from NPR's Culver City studios in L.A. while I was at home in Atlanta. And as we were getting ready to start the interview, I could hear him in my headphones doing something he likes to do when he's just killing time. He started playing the flute.
Oh, man, you got it sounding nice over there.
It's a good time saver, you know?
Like it's so warm, man. It's like...
Oh, man, thank you. Yeah, so I just keep it. So, you know, you check your phone all the time. You kind of just have it in your hand and you look at your phone. Yeah. It's kind of the same thing.
New Blue Sun.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost an hour and a half in length. It's 8 songs that feel orchestral and tribal and contemplative and transcendent all at the same time. It feels like you're taking us to other realms, man, you know, or at least like definitely other realms of Andre.
Yeah, it took me to other realms, to be completely honest. Like, I've been playing flute for years. It got to a point where it was kind of like people were kind of just like sneaking and filming me play.
No doubt.
In space, like in the public, like just out. Like, I might be at Starbucks getting a coffee. I'm waiting on my coffee. I might just start playing somewhere. Like, go outside and play. And then people would just film me and then post it. And then, like, one person actually came up to me on the street and they was like, man, you know, it's a thing. Like, you know, it's a game almost. Like, we're trying to find you and trying to film you play this flute. And that like, kind of was sucky because it was kind of like a Where's Waldo kind of thing.
Where's Waldo,
like a game.
Exactly.
And I didn't like that because, I mean, they just kept getting little nicks of me just kind of messing around, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I just felt like I'd like to share it on a wide scale. Like, I'd really like to play, but it was really for me. Like, I would just walk for hours, and I'm a walker. I love to walk, so I would just walk and play.
Well, let's get into this album, man, because I want to make sure we spend some time talking about it. So let's get to the song titles, because you got some real clever wordplay going on with these song titles. I mean, they feel like part confessional, it's ironic, it's mind-altering, and all, like, super humorous. I would really love if you could read some of them for us, starting with the first song title, because I think it really addresses the elephant in the room right off top.
For sure. So the first song, the title is... I swear I really wanted to make a rap album, but this is literally the way the wind blew me this time. And so for me, like, I already knew how people would be looking at it, and I didn't want to troll people. I didn't want people to think, oh, this Andre 3000 album is coming, and you play it, and like, oh, man, no verses. So even actually on the packaging, you know, you'll see it. It says, warning, no bars. So it's kind of like it's letting you know what it is off the top.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, this is true, man. Like I really, like, you understand, like, I love rap music because it was a part of my youth. So I would love to be out here rapping with everybody rapping because it's almost like fun to being on the playground playing. Like, I would love to be out here playing with everybody, but it's like, it's just not happening for me. So this is the realest thing that's coming right now. Not to say that I would never do it again, but those are not the things that are coming right now, and I have to present what's given to me.
Tell me if I'm wrong, but I also imagine that the legacy of Outkast, like, as great as it is, has maybe in some ways also kind of like weighed you down at times or blanketed your creativity at times.
Nah. It catapulted me, man. Like Outkast was just an incubator to explore, man. Like I'm saying, I couldn't have done a lot of the things if Big Boy didn't support it.
Let's jump to track 3. If you can say the title for that one, that'd be good.
Okay, so track 3 is titled "That Night in Hawaii When I Turned Into a Panther and Started Making These Low Register Purring Tones that I couldn't control. It was wild.
Nah, I ain't gonna lie, man. This sounds like a straight up ayahuasca trip or
that
something like
exactly
that.
What I was talking about.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you gotta tell me the story behind this night, man.
Yeah, I was actually in Hawaii, and it was my second night of the first time I'd ever taken ayahuasca. And we did it like a 3-night kind of phase, but the first night was inviting and beautiful and like the most powerful love and connection with all things I've ever felt in my life. Mm-hmm. The second night was different. And everybody knows that ayahuasca will do you that way. Yeah. So the second night, my stomach was hurting. My mouth contorted like a panther, and I actually turned into a panther, and I was doing like that kind of thing. And I actually turned into a panther and doing this thing called toning. Toning is another way of purging, and toning is where you make these vibrational noises that you can't control, and it started playing me like an instrument. And so I started as a panther, and then I would do these long kind of tones and started changing the notes. So, and I can only mimic it. So on the album, I'm mimicking. But the funny thing was in the ayahuasca session, I was like, damn, I wish I had my phone so I can record this. Cause like, it'd be so dope. It kind of sounds something like this. So it started playing me in a way that goes like, and it's kind of playing me like changing notes, and I'm not doing it. And it holds you for so long, I'm like, where's this breath coming from? So that's what I'm talking about on that title.
Was it scary at the time, or was it like, how did it make you feel at the time?
It was kind of intriguing at the time because, I mean, the sound listener in me, I'm digging the sound. But at the same time, the shaman is coming. He comes over and he's, you know, fanning me. And, you know, he's saying, oh, that's like 20 years of therapy happening right now.
Mm. That's deep. Talk about your passion for instrumental music, like how it started and how you got off into that bag. So more so.
Well, it's really funny. Like as a youngster, I associated jazz music with old people.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, I'm just being honest. Like as a rapper, I associated jazz music with old people and elevator music, like because it had become that. And here's what's hilarious too. Like every generation will do that. So what's funny is at some point in the future, people want to listen to trap music and be like, "Oh, that's nice." No, I'm being honest because it happens because society moves forward and it always does. But I remember when I was like about 20. And I got into actually music and producing and like really understand. And I always like some songs and I'm like, whoa, okay. Like, I mean, the pop songs that I got into, like some of the Take Five or the, Chuck Mangione. Like, I remember that, like playing on the radio as a kid and like humming the melodies. And I was like, oh, okay. So I'm getting affected by, you know, these instrumental cats. And so once I started really getting into it, I'm like, hold up. Like, jazz was the rap of that time. Mm. Like these dudes, they were smoking, they were doing heroin, they were in clubs, they were like like trading, like what we trade verses, they trading like solos, and like you really get into it and you really understand what they were doing and how rebellious what they were doing. Mm. You're like, man, this is the ultimate. And I know from like watching my heroes grow older that your rhythm is kind of it ages you in a certain way, and your vocals age you in a certain way. So I was always trying to figure out a way that I can continue. Like, you can continue rapping for the rest of your life till you're 90 years old, but I've always tried to find a way that was ageless.
Mm.
And when you're listening to a player, a lot of times, like an instrumental player, you may not know their age. And I kind of love that in a way. And not that there's anything wrong with age. And I think we have a thing where we kind of run away from age. Like, I love that I'm 48 now. Like, if I could go back to being 21, I would not. And that's just the truth. Like, sometimes I look in the mirror, I'm like, man, you have silver hair. And I'm like, that's so awesome. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm a silverback gorilla.
My conversation with Andre 3000 about his new album, New Blue Sun, we'll continue
right after this short break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the acclaimed true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. When you keep your stress bottled up, it can eat away at you. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to make them better. Try BetterHelp Online Therapy, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp at BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy: family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit TeladocHealth.com/What's Your Why for more information. That's TeladocHealth/What's Your Why.
This election season, you can expect to hear a lot of news, some of it meaningful, much of it not. Give the Up First podcast 15 minutes, sometimes a little less, and we'll help you sort it out, what's going on around the world and at home. 3 stories, 15 minutes, Up First every day. Listen every morning, wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get into some flute talk, man. We started talking flutes at the beginning a little bit. Like you said, you play a digital wind instrument on this song and several other songs. How many flutes do you own?
Maybe about 30, 40 flutes.
Wow. Okay, I did not expect that.
Yeah, but I have to say, like, it's because, like, I started with one style of flute. The style of flute that I started with was introduced to me by Cassia. Cassia, she's a world-class surfer, and she was playing this flute at this breathwork class. And as soon as she started playing, my ears popped up. I'm like, what is that sound? And I had to go up to her and ask her, like, what is that? And so she introduced me to my flute master, the guy that makes my flute, Guillermo Martinez. And that style of flute that he makes was my intro into flutes. And so, like, I was living in New York at a point, and so when I get into an Uber or get into a taxi, I always play. And so what started to happen, like, depending on the taxi driver, like, whatever nationality they were, like, if they were Chinese or if they were African or East Indian, a driver, they would always turn around and be like, oh, that reminds me of my country. Like, oh, man, have you ever heard of the Bansuri flute, which is an Indian flute? Or, oh, have you heard of the Ney flute, you know, which is Egyptian or Turkish flute? And so I'm kind of getting schooled by different cultures on different flutes. So when I say I have a lot of flutes, I have mostly my style of flutes made by Guillermo, but I started to just collect a lot of different flutes from a lot of different countries. Every culture has a flute. The flute is the first instrument ever after the drum. The drum came first, and then flute. So flute is the first instrument where we actually heard a musical tone or a note, you know, so it's always interesting to me about flutes in that way. And one thing I like about flutes and wooden flutes in particular is it's the closest to the human voice out of all the instruments. And I think that's why I kind of gravitated towards it, because when you're hearing a flute player or saxophonist, like, you're actually hearing the wind of that human.
It's one thing to talk about your evolution as an artist, but, you know, even as a person, you've been through a lot that honestly, I don't know if fans always remember to take into account when we make, like, these selfish demands, what feel like selfish demands for more music from artists that we love. But, you know, in your case, in the last decade, you lost both your mom and your dad, and more recently your stepdad, who I know you've said was really an anchoring person in your life. That's a lot of grief, man, for anybody to hold, especially back to back. Like, how did managing all of that, did it make music or just your art and craft feel any less essential or more essential in any kind of way?
No, I wouldn't say that. It just kind of makes you just remember things. It makes you remember the times that you and your mom had, or the times you and your dad had, or, you know, the times that your stepdad told you certain things. So I just had a conversation with Guillermo, my flute maker, and he was telling me that there's a responsibility that comes with flute playing. When I first started playing, maybe 2 years after I had my flute, I went back to Guillermo to kind of get a checkup on my flute and, you know, to get it tuned and clean and stuff like that. And he kind of pulls me to the side and he's like, hey, I noticed that you're really into these flutes. I have to tell you, like, not a warning, but it's, I have to tell you that there will come a time when you play and people will cry. And it's happened to me like a few times now. Like, it's like grown men, like, crying. Like, one time I'm in a taxi and this, once I get in, I usually start playing, and this guy turns around crying. And he was like, when you play, he's like, my mother died last night. And when you play, it makes it feel like she's right here in the seat with me.
Wow.
And so, you know, we were having this conversation, me and Guillermo, and he was like, yeah, he was like, I get asked to play at funerals now, or when somebody know they're about to pass, and, you know, the last days, sometimes the family will call me to play. And I was like, whoa, that's crazy, because I was recently asked to play at a funeral and I denied it. And so when Virgil passed, his family asked, would I play?
Wow.
At the funeral, and I denied it, but only because I felt like I would be a distraction, or it would be, you know, like this, you know, I don't know. I just felt like, it would have taken away from the moment. And so when I told Guillermo, he was like, yeah, sometimes you have to look at it now as a responsibility to play. They asked you to play for a reason. So yeah, I just wanted to, lay that out, because, when my mom passed, I don't know, I had this urge to play, but I wasn't even playing flute back then. I just wanted to, I think I was more on guitar at that point.
Okay.
And I just didn't. I don't think I could go through with it, but I don't know. I think New Orleans has it best. Like,
yeah.
I think the funeral kind of, the way we do funerals, I think is really antiquated and sad. Yeah. I think we need to party more, or like
celebration.
Yeah, I think New Orleans got it.
Thank you, bro.
Yeah. Thank you, man.
Thanks again to my colleague, Rodney Carmichael. You can find his full hour and 13-minute interview with Andre 3000 at npr.org. Andre's new album, New Blue Sun, is out now.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany. This is Felipe from New York. Grammy nominations just came out this year, and I was stoked to see I'm Just Ken making the list. But I was also wondering what you thought about who else has been nominated this year. Thanks.
Hey, Felipe. Thank you so much for calling in with this question. You know, when I am thinking about these Grammy nominations this year, only one name comes to mind, and that is my queen, the best, America's sweetheart, Victoria Monet. If you do not know this woman's name, allow me to tell you, after years of writing for artists like Fifth Harmony and Ariana Grande, mind you, she's won a Grammy for Ariana Grande before. She wrote some of the songs that you and I have loved over these years. Thank You Next, Seven Rings. But Victoria Monet, this year, with the debut of Jaguar 2, has really come into her own lane as an artist. Now, I'll say I've been listening to her for about 5-6 years now. Even if you go on Twitter and you type in my handle and Victoria Monet, like, probably 8 or 9 tweets come up where I'm just like, I love her music. She's making the anthems. She's taking it. Okay, I've been talking about this woman nonstop. I'm just glad that the rest of America has caught up with me. She is also a new mother. She took time from her career to have her first child. And it has been amazing to see her embrace motherhood while also going after her dreams at the same time. It's such an inspiration. Like, Victoria Monet is the real deal. I am so glad to see her getting the love she deserves. I'm hoping that my girl is gonna be standing backstage at that press podium with two arms full of awards. Victoria, we love you, girl. Come on the show. Anyway, Felipe, thank you so much for calling in with this question. It gave me an excuse to talk about one of my favorite things in the world, good music. I hope you have a great weekend. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Barton Girdwood,
Alexis Williams,
Liam McBain,
Corey Antonio Rose.
This episode was edited by
Jessica Plachek,
Bilal Qureshi.
Engineering support came from
Phil Edfors.
Our executive producer is
Verilyn Williams.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sanguini.
Our senior VP of programming is
Anya Grundman.
All right, that's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch. Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
All that sitting and swiping, your body is adapting to your technology. Learn how and what you can do about it.
I really felt like the cloud in my brain kind of dissipated. Once I started realizing what a difference these little breaks were making, there's no turning back for me.
Take NPR's Body Electric Challenge. Listen to the series wherever you get your podcasts.